right, folks, we're back today. We're going to be talking about depression and the pharmaceutical industry and various other topics. Today we've got Robert Whittaker. He's an American journalist and author who's written extensively about medicine, science, history, all that stuff, but specifically psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry. So we've got an expert here today. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. And it's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
We were talking before, you had your pipe burst in your house. That's never fun.
It was a busy morning, that's for sure.
Yeah. So first of all, I want to ask you about your academic journey, because I know you got started at places like Harvard and stuff like this. So how'd you get focused all the way into the topic you are in now?
Yeah, I think this is relevant because you'll see I have a very sort of traditional background. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a newspaper reporter for a number of years covering medicine and science. And then after a time as a fellow at MIT on the Knight Science Journalism Fellowship, I did take a position at Harvard Medical School for a couple of years as director of publications. And this was interesting because this was in the sort of mid-90s. This was at a time when there was a lot of talk about evidence-based medicine. And one of the thoughts about evidence-based medicine is that doctors can be deluded about their merits of their therapies. And that's why you needed to have research data and clinical data to inform your care. So that was a sort of a learning experience that you had to become, if you're going to be a good medical journalist, you had to become very sort of keen at analyzing the research literature and really sort of being able to deconstruct it. Then the next sort of part of my path to this moment was I did co-found a publishing company called CensorWatch that looked at the business of clinical trials in this country. And I co-founded that in 1994. We had that for 4 years. And as part of doing the reporting on that, it became evident to me that clinical trials funded by the pharmaceutical companies aren't really scientific exercises. They're really marketing exercises. They design those trials to produce a story that will help their drug be gain success in the marketplace. And while I was doing that, I did come upon, at this point, some abuses of psychiatric patients, both by the NIMH in research studies and in those industry-funded trials. I wrote a series for the Boston Globe about those abuses of patients. And after that series, which actually was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, I got a book contract to write about, you know, the history of treatment of the mentally ill in this country. And really looking at this question, in the 1970s and 1980s, the World Health Organization had conducted two long trials, cross-cultural trials, that compared outcomes for schizophrenia patients in three developing countries, India, Nigeria, and Colombia, with outcomes in the U.S. and other developed countries. And they twice found that over the long term, patients in the poor countries, the developing countries, had much better outcomes. This is schizophrenia diagnoses. And the World Health Organization investigators actually concluded that living in a developed country, if you get diagnosed with schizophrenia, is a strong predictor that you won't have a good outcome. So that is why it was to try to investigate that failure, which was what I was trying to do in my first book, Mad in America. So anyway, that's how I got involved in psychiatry. It was a thing of curiosity. I didn't have any axe to grind. And then I wrote another book eventually called Anatomy of an Epidemic, which we can talk about. But really what I became obsessed by a little bit was this fundamental problem in the United States. And actually in much of the Western world. And that is that the story told by psychiatry about its diagnoses and the merits of its treatments is out of sync with what you find in its own research literature. There's quite a gap between the public story and the story that emerges from a close look at the scientific literature. And really that's been my intent as a journalist, is to make that scientific literature known, because it does lead to a different thinking about mental health, thinking about how to treat it, and that sort of thing. And finally, after I wrote Anatomy of an Epidemic, which was a book that investigated what are the long-term impact of psychiatric drugs, I started something called Mad in America, which is a webzine, in 2011. And the purpose of that webzine is, A, we need to hear from people with lived experience, but B, we need to make that science known. So we have a team of science writers that publish science articles 4 times a week. And if you read that literature, you'll see how much the scientific literature is out of sync with the public narrative. So that's a long-winded story. But I think the important thing is, you know, I was really schooled in evidence-based medicine and how to deconstruct studies. And my interest of this comes as a journalist who, after spending some time, really found this gap between the scientific literature and what was told to the public. And, you know, as a journalist, your obligation is to be a faithful recorder of, quote, the truth. And in this matter, it means saying what is in the scientific literature.
Yeah. In your first book, what were some of the most egregious things that they were doing?
Well, in the first book, Bad in America, you find a couple of themes. That is, and I went back all the way to colonial days. And the first theme is whatever the psychiatrists are doing or the mad doctors are doing, they're going to declare it successful. So a lobotomy, for example, surgical lobotomy, which involved removing the frontal lobes, that won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1949 for the person who invented it. And if you look at clinical observations, the clinicians who were doing it, the surgeons who were doing it, psychiatrists were doing it, said, removing the frontal lobes, it can't really hurt the person, it can only help them. And why would they say that? Because they were seeing when if you take someone who's in a manic episode or psychotic, and if you make them quiet, and you make them less of a disturbance, that is seen as a benefit. And that's something you see over and over again in the history of therapies that are used to treat, quote, the mad. And by the way, when the first antipsychotic came to market, which was Thorazine in the mid-1955, it was not seen as an antipsychotic. It was seen as a neuroleptic, something that took hold of the nervous system. And it affected a change very similar to a surgical lobotomy. They said it was like a chemical lobotomy. Now, today we see that's a problem. But at the time, because 6 years earlier, surgical lobotomy had won the Nobel Prize, that was seen as a good thing. The chemical could do the same as what surgery was doing. So anyway, that's sort of what you see in this history up until 1955. We get the psychiatric drugs arrive in 1955. First, the antipsychotics, then the benzodiazepines, then the antidepressants. And just following the thread for the psychotic patients, there is a mystery that emerges within the first 20 years, which is relevant to the conversation we're going to have.
Yeah.
That is, when they did these studies with patients, they did say that they diminish psychotic symptoms better than placebo in hospitalized patients, okay, when they first tried Thorazine and Haldol, et cetera. However, by the mid-60s, they were noticing this. Relapse rates were now seemed to be higher than they were before. Social dependency seemed to be higher than it was before. And as early as 1965, you get doctors at a Boston psychopathic hospital saying, wait a minute, maybe these drugs still psychotic symptoms a little bit better than placebo over the short term, but are they making people less functional over the long term? So that arose in 1965. Then there were a series of studies done in the 1970s by the NIMH that revisited this question. How are antipsychotics affecting long-term outcomes? And so they would have a group that got antipsychotics, and then they have a group that was treated without antipsychotics, but with intensive psychosocial care. And in all three studies, the group that were treated without regular use of antipsychotics did better. So, and this were in studies that lasted between 1 and 3 years. So at that point, one of the lead schizophrenia doctors in the country said, you know, these drugs may be helpful over the short term, but once people go on the drugs, maybe they cause some change in the brain that makes them more vulnerable to relapse and less functional over the long term. So maybe what we're doing is making this disorder more severe, more chronic, and impairing long-term function. So that came out in 1980, but the public never heard about it. And then, just to give you another example, just to finish this story, the best longitudinal study of schizophrenia outcomes in the United States was done by a man named Martin Harrow and Thomas Joe. It began in the late 1970s. And it's just a naturalistic study. They study people coming into two Chicago area hospitals, one private, one public. And then the patients are discharged. They're all treated with antipsychotics in the hospital. Then they're discharged. And then they just follow them. They see how they're doing it 2, 4.5 years. 7.5 years, 10, 15, and 20. Now, their hypothesis was that the patients who took themselves off the drugs didn't comply with, the doctor's orders, would have much worse outcomes. What they found was precisely the opposite. By year two, those who were had come off the meds were now doing better. And by the time, as this went forward, those off their meds were actually more, once they got stabilized off the meds, were much more likely to remain stable, not have psychotic symptoms. And their recovery, long-term recovery rate was 8 times higher than for those who regularly took their medications. Now, this was an NIMH-funded study. It's the best longitudinal study that has been conducted in the last 60 years. And have you heard of it?
No.
Okay. Now, if the results had been the opposite, they would have been promoted to the public.
Sure.
An 8 times higher recovery rate. Because this is functioning, work habits, socialization. But because they weren't promoted, it didn't fit the narrative, they weren't promoted to the public. No major newspaper ever reported on them. What we did at Madden America is we reported on all their research. I did also in Anatomy of an Epidemic, but they published numerous studies throughout the past decade, expanding on this reach. We were the lone media outlet, I'm talking about Madden America, that was reporting on these findings from this long-term longitudinal study in the United States. Now, by the way, there have been longitudinal studies now in other countries that are basically finding the same thing. And this is, in my opinion, one of the best examples of what, you ask me, why am I doing this? Because I think the public needs to know if the best longitudinal study said the recovery rate was 8 times higher for schizophrenia off medication, they should incorporate that into their thinking.
Yeah.
So that's my fundamental reason for being engaged in this arena.
They don't have commercials for, you know, less consumption. They have commercials for more consumption. So if it's like, don't take this or whatever, you don't need this, you'll never find out in a capitalist system. But yeah, I'd rather have a front, you know, bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy. But you brought up the point about societal boxes and cramming people into these societal boxes. Historically, if we could keep them quiet, that was sort of the point, rather than what's actually good for this person. And we're just, maybe, are we finding out more and more every day, I guess?
Well, certainly with those who are labeled seriously mentally ill, you see this, you see that basically, of course, it's whatever we do, we paint it to the public as it's good for the patient. But so often the patients say, this isn't good for me. These drugs, I don't like them. They make me into zombies. I can't work. I can't think, etc. So you have these competing aims. One aim, frankly, you say is to help the person gain a normal life. But the other aim is a societal aim, to quiet the person, make them less visible, make them less difficult. And so sometimes the therapies, including drugs, do achieve that end for society. They make people quieter and less disruptive. But that's not serving the patient. And you see this conflict throughout history when it comes to mad patients.
Yeah, that's really a shame.
And I use mad in the word, you know, psychotic patients.
I know, I like that. I like that. It's very to the point as far as the ridiculousness of the entire industry itself. In your book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, which is your latest, right? You're saying that a lot of these are turning some episodic disorders into chronic disabilities. Now, what else is going on there? I mean, and how?
Yeah, just real quickly. I did write when I co-wrote another book called Psychiatry and Influence, but that's the last sort of major trade book that I did.
Okay.
An epidemic. Well, just to set the scene here is, you know, we have studies funded by industry that are meant to assess whether a psychiatric drug, whether it be an antidepressant or an antipsychotic, diminishes symptoms over a short period of time better than placebo, right? If that happens, they're seen as beneficial, they go on the market. But people take these drugs for 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. And so you want to ask this question, what does science say about the long-term impact of these drugs on, say, depression, on, say, anxiety, on, say, ADHD? And let's even say on schizophrenia. Now, earlier I told you there was this surprising turn in the story about schizophrenia and antipsychotics. Because if we're, as a society, believe in any drugs that are needed to be taken long-term, it's the antipsychotics. That's a belief that we hold dear, so to speak.
Okay.
And yet here is in the research literature, this other story that's saying that, well, maybe they're effective over the short-term in diminishing symptoms, but the long-term, they're causing some change in the brain that makes them more vulnerable biologically to the psychosis than they would be in the normal course of their illness. So what did I want to do in Anatomy of an Epidemic? It was the method of research and assessment. In order to understand whether a treatment is affecting, how it's impacting long-term outcomes, you have to understand first, what is the natural capacity to recover in nature? So for example, let's say depression. You take a group of depressed patients, and what is the likelihood they would recover if they weren't treated with antidepressants, but they just spoke to their priests or they did old school stuff? So what if you were around in 1970, and you went to the NIMH literature, what would they tell you about the natural course of depression? Well, they said this, and this is the leading depression doctors in the country. Depression tends to regularly remits on its own. And at the end of 1 year, even with hospitalized depression, 85% will be well. And only 15% who've suffered a severe initial episode will become chronically ill. And so they even spoke about, well, what's the purpose of antidepressants if you basically are supposed to get better naturally? And they said, well, they can speed up that healing process. So that was the understanding of antidepressants when they were first introduced, that they could reduce the time you were depressed and speed up this natural remission, okay? Now, so the antidepressants really start to be used with some frequency in the 1970s, and then they really take off in the 1980s. But as doctors, clinicians began to use them in the 1970s, you begin to see this comment emerge, at least among some clinicians. Yeah, I think my depressed patients may be getting better faster, but it seems they're now relapsing more frequently than they were before. And are the drugs causing a chronification of the disease? Okay, so this is raised in the 1970s. Now, in the 1980s, the NIMH convenes a conference and says, well, what is the natural course of depression? And this is a key moment. Yeah, they bring together experts. But now remember, the 1980s, the psychiatrists that are bringing together experts are often working as consultants for the drug companies. So they don't want to blame the drugs on anything. And they say this, we used to think that depression was an episodic disorder and you'd recover naturally. But now we know it's a chronic disorder. So because we're now seeing people more chronically depressed, those on antidepressants, but they don't blame the drugs at this time. They say, aha, this is an advance in science. We finally know the true course of this disorder. But of course, what they were seeing was the new course of the disorder for people who were being medicated with antidepressants. And as early as 1994, a man named Giovanni Fava, who's an Italian researcher, said, I think we have a problem with these drugs. I think these drugs cause a biological change that has two problems. It increases the risk of relapse when you come off the drug, but they may also cause something called a tardive or persistent dysphoria over the long term if you stay on the drugs in a high percentage of patients. And now over the next 20 years, researchers, if you look into the literature, even put out a biological explanation for what was happening, or at least their thought. This was the hypothesis. So antidepressants, as we know, they block the normal reuptake of serotonin from the synaptic cleft, right? That's why they're called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Mm. So serotonin is a neurotransmitter that, you know, is the way the neurons in the brain communicate. You have a presynaptic neuron. It releases serotonin into that tiny gap, binds with receptors on the postsynaptic one, and that's how messages are passed. Now, in order to have that messaging system working, that serotonin has to be removed from the synaptic cleft, okay? It's a pulse system. What the drugs do is they block that normal removal. Serotonin stays longer in the gap. And so that up serotonergic activity, and that was said to be why the drugs work, they up serotonergic activity. However, the researchers never found that people with depression had low serotonergic activity before they went on the drug. They had normal serotonergic activity. But they found that once you go on the drug, the brain has all these feedback loops. So now the brain is saying, uh-oh, my serotonin is staying in that synaptic gap too long. And as a feedback loop, in order to maintain what's called a homeostatic equilibrium, sort of the normal functioning of the serotonin system, it dials down its own serotonergic machinery. It decreases its own output of serotonin, and it decreases the density of its serotonergic receptors. So here's the irony that was never told to the public. The public was being told that people with depression have slow serotonin. These drugs work by fixing, upping serotonergic activity and bringing it back into balance. What the science shows is they didn't find that people had serotonergic abnormalities before they went on the drugs, but that the drugs perturb normal serotonergic function. The brain in response goes through this compensatory adaptation and is now operating, and this is in the words of a former director of the NIMH, the brain is now operating in a manner that is both qualitatively and quantitatively different than normal. These are abnormalizing agents. And then further researchers said, oh, this is why we're getting such relapses when people come off, because the brain has become dependent on the antidepressants. And at the same time, they said the fact that you're driving your brain into this low serotonergic state, at least in some patients, you're going to get a chronic dysphoria. And that this really is not so much a depression as sort of an inability to feel. You get a lot of sexual dysfunction, that sort of thing. And all this really sort of came together by the time I was writing Anatomy of an Epidemic. You have researchers talking about this. Or you could trace the story about the low serotonin theory. And then you had studies that looked at what is the long-term course of depression today. And there was an NIMH story. Let's revisit the question of outcomes for unmedicated depressed patients. So what happened in the unmedicated depressed patients? At the end of 1 year, how many were well? What was the old number? 85%.
Holy smokes.
Now, in the biggest study that was ever done, called the STAR-D study, it had 4,041 patients who entered the study. They were given various chances to remit, and then the idea, if they got better, the depression went away, they would stay in clinical care, stay on their antidepressants, and remain. The hope was they would then still be well at the end of 1 year, okay? And this was a study that was supposed to guide our clinical thinking. But what happened is the outcomes were horrific. Now, there was a fraudulent outcome that was actually initially reported that has now just been revealed as fraud. But what really was the story was that at the end of 1 year, of the 4,041 patients who entered the study, only 35% ever remitted, even for a brief time. And at the end of 1 year, only 3% had remitted and stayed well and in clinical care. So we have a documented stay well rate in the largest antidepressant trial ever conducted for medicated patients of 3%. We have a stay well rate or get well rate for unmedicated patients of 85%.
Now, holy shit.
That 3% includes a lot of dropouts, but generally people are dropping out of care because they're not doing well, not really working. So even we've had other now studies in real world patients, and generally you'll find only about 25 to 30% of patients, like say first episode patients, put on an antidepressant remit, meaning their symptoms go completely away. They might diminish some, but that's actually what you see, 25 to 30%. And finally, there's this. If you really drill down into the people who tend to say that the drugs work for them, these are people who are struggling with anxiety, not depression. And the drugs sort of modulate, diminish your sort of responsiveness to the world, which is why they may be okay for anxiety. But what we really hear when we hear about people doing so well, it's not people who are severely depressed so often and then got better. There's some. But so often it's really people who are functioning okay, they were anxious, they take this, and they're now less anxious.
So there's been a long history of psychiatry trying to pinpoint, you know, who's crazy, who's not. And then at some point they tested the entire populace and found, you know, everybody's got some kind of disorder. And then we begin the, you know, drugging of America that began when I was born up until the 90s and stuff when everybody's doing this. So obviously there are other things that are to account for people's mental conditions. And you've written about the dangers of antidepressants, but also the rise of mental illness in America. So what is driving all of these a lot of these conditions?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's one so central to sort of our societal health, so to speak, societal self-understanding. The first thing that's driving this is that in 1980, the American Psychiatric Association published the third edition of its Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and it reconceptualized mental disorders. Before within the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, its second edition, many problems in life were understood to be psychological reactions to difficulties in your life. You got divorced, you lost your job, someone died that you cared for, that sort of thing, or poor health was as well. So they weren't really, psychosis was, at least in some patients, was seen as being a disease of the brain, in some patients, not all. But what in 1980, they said, okay, we're going to take all these things that people complain of and we're going to say they're diseases of the brain. Okay? But there was no science behind that. There was no scientific discovery that showed there was an abnormality in the brain that led to depression, or there was an abnormality in the brain that led to ADHD, the symptoms of ADHD, or the abnormality that made you anxious. But this is the story they decided to tell. And the reason they decided to tell this is because in the 1970s, there was sort of a rebellion against a psychiatry, as seen as sort of a failed discipline. And, you know, their Freudian talk therapy being no better than what a counselor gave or what the priest gave, or et cetera. And their benzodiazepines, which had become the popular drugs, Valium and stuff, were seen as addictive. So there was sort of an anti-psychiatry movement that rose up in academia, saying psychiatrists weren't real doctors. They operated morally for forces of social control. So psychiatry said to ourselves, we need to rebrand ourselves. We need to move away from the couch, and we need to put on the white coat and tell the American public we treat diseases of the brain. We will present as like infectious disease doctors. And that's why in 1980, they adopted this disease model, and then they set out to sell it. And the chemical imbalance story was a way they sold it. They said, listen, these drugs fix chemical imbalances in the brain. Now, that story actually arose just from understanding how the drugs acted on the brain and not actually what was happening to patients. So now they conceive of everything now, ordinary problems as diseases. We're going to call them mental illnesses. That's number one. Number two, psychiatrists started working for drug companies as consultants, key opinion leaders. And so they were getting money. And guess what the drug companies wanted to see? Expanded diagnostic categories. So you see that as a DSM-3, the revised effort, they expand that. They make it easier to diagnose ADHD. They make it easier to diagnose depression. And so, and bipolar disorder. Then we get DSM-4, same thing. We expand these boundaries and we call them diseases, but you can put these boundaries wherever you want them. So for example, initially ADHD, which is seen as like, now you're bothering people in school, which basically is when the diagnosis happens. Initially they said it was 3%. Okay. So they do a study and they say, okay, the ones that score highest on being, you know, obnoxious or talking too much or jittering or whatever, the top 3% of score that, we're going to say have ADHD, meaning that if you were in the 4%, you didn't have it. But then they said, no, let's make it the 5%. Then let's make it 10%. You can set that boundary line wherever you want it. And that's why we got this expansion of ADHD, who loved it, drug companies. But it also gave a steady supply of patients to psychiatrists, et cetera. So it worked to sort of build up the influence of psychiatry in our country. So finally, though, one final thing is we increase those who get diagnosed. We say they have disorders, and then we give them drugs. And what do you see over and over again with long-term use of the drugs? They increase the chronicity of those disorders, meaning you're more likely to still have symptoms years later, and you're more likely to become functionally impaired. Now, when I say that more likely, the reason that is so impactful is that in nature, there is such a capacity to recover from most of these things, whether it be depression, anxiety. Kids who are sort of goofing off in school tend to grow up and make their way in life.
Right.
So, but we have reconceptualized these as diseases. And so now that's how people see themselves and they stay in treatment. So I do think there are factors in society that are making it difficult for kids, social media and that sort of thing, inequality, capitalism, go on and on. But we do have a discipline, a medical discipline, that has created a framework for calling more and more people mentally ill, starting at a very young age, such as you said you grew up in this.
Sure.
And then, frankly, you have treatments that tend to quantify the disease. So that's why we're having such a problem.
Yeah. And, you know, I grew up in a high school where they were giving out those kind of medications to most any kid that would go and, you know, say that he was having trouble in school. But at the same time, the high school had contracts with Pepsi and had, you know, sugary drink dispensers on every corner of every hallway in this high school. We are just shooting ourselves in the foot and desperately looking for a Band-Aid.
You know, that's a scenario that is just so awful.
Isn't it?
You're selling your school kids as a market to, you know, Coca-Cola, to sugar companies, yeah, to, you know, soda makers. You're literally selling them, putting them as a market that they can do, even though we know that these drinks are terrible for the kids, right? Yeah. And then when the kids do get wired, we say, oh, they're jumping out of their seats. Now we'll give them a stimulant to slow, you know, to sort of quiet them. That's literally what happened.
I know.
Now, are you valuing your kids? Are you nurturing them? Are you creating a situation where they can grow up and thrive? Just real quickly, do you know there was a movement in the 90s to really improve the diet of kids in a few schools? So one of the things is they brought in people that would cook with fresh food and do healthy diets, starting with breakfast. They teach kids how to cook. And guess what happened to ADHD, like in the couple of schools where this was tried out as an experiment? It virtually disappeared.
Right.
Because kids were eating well, they learned how to cook, they started becoming, you know, aware of nutrition. And by the way, they got rid of the Coca-Cola machines in the school hallways,
right,
too.
Right, there you go. This is what comes to my next question, was about alternatives to also antidepressants, which there are, I'm assuming, many, many things that you can do before you could resort to this sort of heavy, you know, sedatives and stuff. What do you think are some of the best alternatives to ADHD, but also antidepressant medication?
Okay, just start with antidepressants.
Okay.
So often, you know, depression is a response to a problem in the environment, right? Something bad has happened to people. Some, you know, there's stressors on you, and something maybe bad has happened, and maybe you're not eating well, maybe you're working two jobs, whatever it might be, having a breakup. So the first thing is to realize that environment matters. So the question is, can you change your environment in some way? Can you exercise more? Can you eat better? Can you find a social thing to engage in, whether it be bowling or volunteering or that sort of thing? But the biggest thing is, rather than being pessimistic and saying that you have this brain disease, is to understand, listen, depression comes and goes. Most everybody at some point in life is going to feel depressed. And often, you know, now and then. But that human beings are really, if we look at the natural spectrum of outcomes, they're very resilient. These things do tend to clear up on its own. And there's even research showing out there that, in a way, depressive symptoms serve an evolutionary purpose. They're telling you, you need to make some changes in your life, whether it be getting diet, sleep, that sort of thing. So when I talk about alternatives to antidepressants, the question is, or the advice is this. Remember, we human beings are built to be responsive to our environments. If you're depressed, that's probably a sign that there's something in your environment that isn't so nurturing, whether it be social, job, food, lack of exercise. It can be many, many things. But it really is a sign that, can you make changes? Can you, and make changes, lean on friends, and also have this optimism that it will remit, that it'll go away with time. So instead of being pessimistic, be optimistic. Yeah. That's with antidepressants. With ADHD in kids, well, you know, we did raise kids for many, many hundreds of years without stimulants.
Really?
Okay. Yes, we did. So the point is, are you creating, and most of this, so much of this problem arises in schools, right? Oh, they said their kid isn't doing well enough in school or whatever, they're not paying attention. Well, for example, there's a guy named Howard Glasser who has invented something called, or developed something called the Nurtured Heart Approach. And what he does is goes into schools, and rather than try to fix the children, he fixes the schools. He works with the teachers to create environments that stir curiosity in the kids, make them feel good about them being there, make them feel intelligent, challenge the kids. So rather than have a school environment where you sit in a chair for hours on end, and by the way, now we don't let them go out and play as much as we used to, right? And then we also send them home with homework. Horrible ideas with young kids. We need to build environments that are made for 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds. And what do 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds, what do they want to do? They're curious. They want to learn. They also are interested in socializing with each other. They need to be physically active. They need to have time to run around and do exercise and gym and that sort of thing. And you know what? They love music. So music classes are good. Art classes are good. And then there's really no purpose to 3 hours of homework for these kids. So my point is, if we have 10, 15% of our kids aren't doing well in school and need drugs, clearly one of the problems is the schools aren't built for the kids. So create environments. It's the same idea. Human beings are responsive to their environments. If you have people who are not responding well to an environment, that's probably a sign there's some problem with the environment. And let's be honest with a lot of kids now today too. They go home and often their parents are stressed out. Often both of them are working. You know, often they have to get themselves off to school. So the way we've organized our society, rather than saying we have all these kids who are ill, it's a message saying as a society, we're not doing a good job raising our kids. That's what we should be thinking.
Yeah, we should be reconsidering what school is and what education is, and the disconnect between, you know, living in this for-profit society where, you know, a lot of fatherless families, single moms, you know, overworked, stressed out. It's classic. It's very, stereotypical of Western life. So, but one more question I wanted to ask you before we go is, you've criticized the pharmaceutical industry a lot, and obviously we do a lot of, you know, ragging on capitalism on this show. What are some of the most egregious things that you've seen these pharmaceutical companies get themselves into?
Well, the pharmaceutical companies, and this really took hold in the late 80s and the early 90s. First of all, they just started designing their trials to prove a marketing message, okay? And second of all, they became the ones that analyzed their own data and prepared their own reports. And what they got involved with really clearly, really early on was, once the switch happened, was hiding adverse events. So they would hide suicidal events, for example, in the antidepressant trials and the antidepressant trials of kids. And there's another thing that you basically would see them, and you'd see them sort of sift through the data to find some sort of outcome that was, you know, beneficial on the drug, and they'd emphasize that and hide, for example, suicide risk and that sort of thing. But honestly, then what happened, they would do, of course, is they would send out their marketing people to teach prescribers to use the drugs, and they give them little gifts and that sort of thing. And they paid doctors a lot of money to be their key opinion leaders and give CME courses to other prescribers. So what the pharmaceutical industry did is, A, they designed their trials to make the drugs look good. B, they sifted through their data to, you know, cherry pick good outcomes and hide adverse outcomes. And then C, they basically co-opted psychiatrists at academic schools to be their, quote, key opinion leaders or key thought leaders. They paid them money to give talks at conferences. And then they paid, you know, sort of more ordinary docs, local docs, to also give local talks. So they became very good at basically, in writ large, telling a false story of drugs that work better than they actually do and hiding adverse effects. And in essence, buying doctors, okay, with their sort of goodies. As bad as that is, the NIMH studies of National Institute of Mental Health studies are more corrupt than anything the industry has done. In other words, you see more data manipulation, you see more hiding of adverse events in the NIMH-funded study, say, for example, the MTA study of stimulants for ADHD. That was done in the 1990s. It was said this is the first long-term study of stimulants for ADHD. This will guide clinical care. And guess what they found by year three? Being on stimulants was a marker not of benefit, but of deterioration. But was that outcome promoted to the public? No. At the end of 6 years, those on stimulants were more likely to be actually have worse ADHD symptoms, higher delinquency rates, and higher rates of functional impairment. Did you read to that? Did you ever know about that?
No.
And then right now we have, it just so happens that there's a big to-do around the fraud in the STAR-D study. In fact, you can go on Mad in America, and I just wrote a report on this. So in the STAR-D study, which was the largest antidepressant trial ever conducted, it was funded by the NIMH, and when they launched it in the early 2000s, they said, this will be a study in real-world patients, and the outcomes will guide clinical care, okay? Big study, important. And they announced, and the way it was designed, if people didn't get better on the first drug, they could try a second one. If they didn't get better on the second, they could try a third in a combination. They get four tries to get better. And they announced in November of 2006 that 67% remitted of the 4,041 patients, 67% remitted, just got better. Now, they didn't announce the one-year results, okay? There was a graphic in there, but they just sort of didn't announce the one-year results. Well, what really happened? And you can go on to madinamerica.com right now and read what really happened, because there's been researchers who've gone back to the using freedom of information requests to get access to the actual data. The actual remission rate was not 67%, it was 35%. And the way they jumped it up from 35 to 67, there was all these protocol violations. The worst was they took a number of people who weren't depressed enough to enter the study, and they went ahead and called them remitted. They include them as remitted patients. You can read it. It's really quite amazing. And then they were the ones that reported that the actual stay well rate at the end of 1 year was 3%. So in this major study, which was promoted to the public, heavily promoted, and the first outcomes in 2006, this still becomes the study cited for the effectiveness of antidepressants in real-world patients. You'll read 67% saw their symptoms remit. In truth, it was 35%, and only 3%, the documented stay-well rate was at the end of 12 months was 3%. That's worse than anything the industry does.
This is stereotypical for any business in America, too. It just so happens the overhead is so good with pharmaceuticals that they have so much cash on hand to just blow on marketing and blow on, you know, creating these things. And you just really depressed me by telling me the NIMH is so corrupt, because this is one of the premier scientific journals that we look to for science, right? The quest for truth.
Right. And what happens, though, NIMH is dominated by psychiatrists at academic medical schools, and the academic medical, and then the people who get the grants to conduct the trials often have connections to the pharmaceutical companies. So for example, in the STAR-D trial, yes, it was funded by the NIMH, but the 12 investigators on the trial, and I looked at this published something about this in my book, our book, Psychiatry and Influence. How many financial ties did they have to drug companies, the 12? Take a guess.
How many ties out of all the people that did the study?
Yeah, so there was 12.
12. How many of them? 10.
How many ties did they have?
10. 12?
151.
What do you mean? Oh, so different companies that they've worked for or taken money from?
Yes, different pharmaceutical companies.
Well, if you're in for a penny, in for a pound.
They had 13 different contracts with drug companies. So now when they get now you can understand why they did all these protocol violations to get the 67%. Because they don't want to report these drugs are only 35%. That will change public opinion, right?
Right.
And how about if they report that only 3% are wealthy in the one? You think the drug companies wanted that news out there?
It's not something you put on a billboard.
Do you think academic psychiatry wanted it out there?
No.
So you think NIMH is this pure thing without ties to industry. The problem is they give grants to people who have deep ties to industry.
Right.
And there's guild interest.
And we're still at this point where Coca-Cola, they can still go around saying that their product is healthy to some degree, but that whole facade is breaking away as we speak, because there are articles and studies being done that show having a Coca, even one whole Coca-Cola a day, is really not good for you. It's actually horrible for you. But we got to go. I want to thank you for coming. You please come back and let's talk again, because we didn't have enough time, and I'd love to talk more with you. Robert Whitaker.
So thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, please. And give a quick shout out to all the places we could find you, Madden America, et cetera.
Yeah, the easiest way is just to go to maddenamerica.com. We publish a daily webzine. You can find the science there. You can research what I've been talking about, find the scientific studies. And you can also go to the About menu there, drop down, contact Robert Whitaker, and you can send me an email.
Send him an email, folks. He likes to... He's a great guy to talk to, I'll tell you that much. We'll sign off. There'll be links in the description down there for the books and everything, so you can find them down there. So thanks again, Robert. Let's talk after this. We'll sign off to everybody. Bye, everybody. See you next time.
Thanks. Thank you.